This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. It's been a year since Hurricane Matthew hit North Carolina, and some communities are still picking up the pieces. The storm caused serious flooding and more than two dozen deaths in this state. Today, many residents in eastern North Carolina are rebuilding their lives, but still can't return to their homes because of water damage. I'll talk with some of our reporters about the ongoing recovery efforts. First, Lisa Phillip, WNC's education reporter. She's been covering an elementary school in Robeson County that is still closed after Hurricane Matthew. Students of West Lumberton Elementary have been using classrooms at a local junior high school, but the future of their school is uncertain. Lisa, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Tell us more about West Lumberton School and how it was affected by the hurricane.
So it's a very interesting school. It's very diverse, mostly African-American, Lumbee Indian and Hispanic, and also low-income. And the storm left about 2 to 3 feet of standing water sitting in the school. And of the seven schools in Robeson County that were still damaged, this is the only school that is still closed. And on top of that, the principal said that estimated that about 90 to 95% of the students there lost their homes as well. So, you know, these students have had a very rough year, to say the least.
And interestingly enough, it's a school that is, you say it's still closed. It's a high-performing school.
Yeah, that's right. You know, despite everything the students went through last year, they still had some of the better test scores in the county, and they continue to do well.
And as you say, so many of the families not only lost their school but their homes. I know you spoke with the principal, Tara Bullard, about the school's efforts to provide for the kids after the storm. Let's listen.
We provided clothes if they needed that. We sent home, lots of times we sent home just personal care items, toothbrushes, toothpaste, deodorant, things like that. Not only for the kids, but for parents too, because, you know, our parents were just doing everything they could to keep the children at this school.
That's West Lumberton Elementary School Principal Tara Bullard, and I'm talking with education reporter Lisa Phillip. So now, where are the students from West Lumberton?
So they're at a nearby junior high school where they have pretty much their own building to themselves, which has alleviated a lot of the fears that parents were facing, that teachers were facing, and having these younger kids who are, you know, kindergarten through fifth grade on a school campus with older students. But, you know, from what I saw, the school almost doesn't look temporary. There are decorations all over the classrooms. You know, from what I heard from the principal, a lot of classroom materials have been donated by people across the state, even people outside of the state. And so they've really made this new building almost their home.
I'm curious to know why West Lumberton is the only one that hasn't been restored. Is it because that had the most damage?
From what I've heard, it is the school building that has retain the most damage. So I would guess that's why it still hasn't reopened.
So they're in a new place now. They're sharing space. They've got their own little enclave within the middle school. It looks like home, but it's not. And the question is, where are they going to go? Will they be dispersed or will they get their own school back, I guess?
Right. And there are a lot of factors playing into that decision. The school was already a very small school. It had 150 students before the storm, and now it has 90 because so many families have left the area because there still isn't enough housing in Lumberton where these families can live. So I talked to the superintendent, and she said that staffing these small class sizes, I saw like a kindergarten class with maybe 8 or 9 students and, you know, other classes that just didn't have more than maybe 10 or 15 students. And staffing those small class sizes just isn't the best decision, given that there are much larger class sizes in other schools in the district. And the superintendent essentially said, we have 24,000 kids to think about. And while I care a lot about these 90 students at this school, it's hard to justify maintaining this situation.
The only other justification would be their sense of home at West Lumberton, right? Tell us about how they feel about their school building.
They feel very strongly about it. Most of the teachers there have been there at the school for more than 10 years, which is very uncommon for a school with such a high percentage of disadvantaged students. And the parents just feel really strongly about keeping the school together. You know, the kids have been through so much. Why introduce more change into their lives? And so These are teachers that the parents and the students know and love.
And Tara Bullard, the principal at that school, talked about just that issue.
I think the kids felt like this has always just been a safe haven. They know that when they come here, they're going to be taken care of. We're going to work with them. We're going to meet them, at their level, and, that we have high expectations.
West Lumberton Elementary School Principal Tara Bullard, who spoke with Lisa Phillip, WNC Education reporter. So what's next in the decision-making process? What would it take? I guess it's really two questions. What would it take to rebuild that school, and then when is the decision made?
So I talked with the director of finance, and he said that it would take about $1.7 million to repair the school and also replace all of its contents. I went to the old school building and peeked in through the windows and could see computer equipment like cords and keyboards and computer mouses just piled up in the front lobby. The cafeteria tables were covered with flood damage. Books. So this is all equipment, furniture, desks, chairs, all that, that the school system would essentially have to replace. And what's next in the process is just deciding whether that's going to be worth it for the school system, because they're also facing more pressing needs. The central office of the school system was also badly damaged, and those staff members are in a rented space right now. So
any sense when families might get an answer?
So the superintendent was hesitant to say that would happen anytime soon. She said a decision would probably be made by the county school board later in the school year. And she essentially said, we want the students and their families to focus on learning right now.
All right, well, I want to look at another community in eastern North Carolina that's recovering from Hurricane Matthew. Many residents in the town of Princeville have not been able to return to their homes since the storm. The town hall and other facilities are also closed. And town officials are in the process of deciding whether to move parts of Princeville to higher ground. Joining me now to talk more about this is Leonita Inge, who is WUNC's Race and Southern Culture reporter. Welcome back, Leonita.
Hi, Frank.
Tell us more about Princeville, because this is not the first time they've been affected by a storm like this.
That's right. Well, Princeville right now actually has been a part of a very creative process, I would say. Several landscape architects and planners and engineers came together not too long ago and actually had a charrette and invited the whole community to come out. What do you want? Not only for Princeville, what do you want Princeville to look like, at this point, 1 year after Hurricane Matthew? But, what are we going to do with this 52 acres that's about to be annexed? And that land is close to Highway 64. It's higher than the land that, say, this town hall is on now. And the state is supposed to be buying that land, paying for that land for Princeville to actually try to move some of its essential services to higher ground.
So this is it. The state says we'll buy 52 acres. It will be annexed. It will now be part of Princeville.
Right.
It's higher ground. Move some of these buildings, historic buildings, from the center of Princeville to that. So what's the discussion there? Because on the surface of it, that would seem like the thing to do. But it's not an easy thing to do, right?
Well, it's not an easy thing to do. There are not that many historic, actually, buildings even left in Princeville. Floyd and other storms took care of those buildings a long time ago. But we're talking about, when we say essential, like the fire department, that their old 1960s building is just totally destroyed. You can still see soiled uniforms when you look through the cracked windows there. And the senior center, it looks like they've tried to raise it, but that may be a building that will eventually go to those 52 acres. Now, the question is the town hall. What do you do with that town hall? And Mayor Bobby Jones says he does not want the town hall to be moved.
Let's listen.
It does not make sense for us to move the town hall and ask the citizens to come back, but we're not coming back. What message are we sending? If we move the town hall but tell the citizens to come back, are we saying that the town is not safe?
That's Princeville Mayor Bobby Jones, who spoke with our race and culture reporter, Leonita Inn. So that's his take. What do you get from the townsfolk, though? Is this a troublesome move for people who live there? Has it divided the town?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's divided the town at all. When you talk to residents, actually, the only thing on their minds is getting back in their homes and making sure the home that they're trying to repair right now, and some are living there while it's being repaired, they just don't want to go through this this process again. I mean, you talk to some folks and they say, you know, we actually think a river is running underneath Princeville. You know, they think that, you know, this is just how it's going to always be. And, you know, that's very upsetting because really the history shows and the Army Corps of Engineers have actually said, you know, what's problematic is where Princeville is located. There are all kinds of tributaries and rivers that Princeville is always going to get hit first when it comes to the flood.
And we should take one step back and talk about the historical significance of Princeville itself and why we're talking about this.
And that's right. That's one reason that the mayor does not want to move that town hall is because it sort of overlooks the bridge where the Tar River is, and that's also where Freedom Hill is. And Freedom Hill was a site where former slaves actually congregated and formed what we know as Princeville today.
So we talked about all of these things coming together, the geographic and topographic location of Princeville, its historic significance, and all of these things have to be taken into account. Gavin Smith is someone you talked with about, talked to him about designing this land, and he works with the Department of the Department of City and Regional Planning
at UNC, yes,
at UNC Chapel Hill, and he's leading a project to look at all of this. Let's hear what he has to say.
How do you link the existing town and take advantage of, in essence, what we were thinking about in some ways is almost, for lack of a better term, unrealized potential? There is unbelievable history and culture in the town, but if you were to drive through it without really knowing, you might just drive through and you would see the one sign that says Freedom Hill. But you wouldn't know that there's Freedom Hill and its history, nor would you necessarily know the history of Shiloh Landing, where slaves were offloaded adjacent to town.
Professor Gavin Smith of UNC Chapel Hill. I'm talking to Leonita Inch. Okay, what's the next step and what's the timeline?
Well, right now, Gavin Smith and his team are still putting together all of their notes and their design options, and then they're going to present it to the town of Princeville just to see what works. And, you know, of course, hopefully the town will agree on what to do with that annex 52 acres. But first of all, like the mayor says, we need some money to actually fix this dike to make sure whatever work is done isn't destroyed again. You know, so there's some infrastructure problems and, you know, that they want solved before they actually rebuild anything major, because we know Princeville only has about 2,200 residents, and at least half of them had to leave during the when Matthew hit last year.
Well, mitigation and infrastructure are certainly a topic that is on the mind of Kinston's mayor. What to do to prevent the damage in the first place? And B.J. Murphy is the mayor of Kinston. He's been talking about that. And WUNC Daily News producer Will Michaels spoke with him about just that. Welcome, Will.
Hey, Frank.
Tell us more about the Kinston mayor. Now, B.J. Murphy and his efforts to shift the narrative to prevention.
Yeah, that's exactly what he's been trying to do ever since Hurricane Matthew a year ago, is really, and his main point being that it's easy for us to talk about disaster recovery, because especially when you talk about giving FEMA funds, for instance, to the businesses or the individuals who are affected by Hurricane Matthew, no one's really going to argue with that once a disaster has come through. The harder conversation to have, simply because it takes longer and there are a lot of elements that go into it, is flood mitigation, especially in Kinston. And there are, as he puts it, things to consider upstream and downstream. One of the things that we talked about extensively was this idea that there has been so much development here in the Triangle. We should say that the Neuse River starts here in the Triangle, goes down to Kinston, ends in New Bern. That there, with the more concrete and development that comes with that, there's more runoff, and that means it has consequences downstream. So there's that that comes into it. He's also 37 years old. He has seen four of the top six crests of the Neuse River in Kinston in his own lifetime, in the history of Kinston. And one of those actually happened since Hurricane Matthew, a little more than 6 months after Hurricane Matthew. In May of this year, there was a spring thunderstorm, and even that caused the Neuse River to rise to about 22 feet.
Actually, he was in a hearing when that happened, right?
He's got right. A story he was about on. That. So yeah, he does. He was on his way to Washington to talk with members of Congress about flood mitigation when this happened. He was actually sitting in Senator Burr's office when he brought out his cell phone and said, I have a picture right here. This is not Hurricane Matthew. This just happened today. This is a business that's on our main drag in Kinston that's flooded again. This is simply put into a picture why we need to be talking about this. His point being that we're two steps back. We aren't actually having this conversation about flood mitigation because it's not as easy to have as just giving out money for disaster relief.
Right. The pictures are much better when you come in afterward and talk about all the good things you're going to do. The mitigation question is a harder conversation to have. When he talks about that, what are the things he's looking at? Impervious surfaces in the triangle, there's not much you can do about that, right? There's a lot of concrete here. That makes for more runoff. So what does he think we ought to be looking at and focusing on?
He really, from our conversations, to me, it seems like he's leaving everything on the table, from dredging to additional reservoirs and dams to, again, dredging, for instance, has consequences downstream. A lot of opponents of dredging on the Outer Banks or on North Carolina's coast will tell you that it's okay. It does protect that community right there, but it might have consequences down the way. Now, Kinston is also in a unique position because the Neuse River really winds. It's narrower in Kinston, and it winds through the city. New Bern, it's much wider. There are more flood mitigation measures there than there are in Kinston, but there aren't very many, and there haven't been very many in place for the last 30 or 40 years. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers did a study back in 1965 of the Neuse River Basin, and there have been environmental impact studies since then, but that was really the last major study done when it comes to reservoirs and dams or any potential flood mitigation efforts in the Neuse River, the entire Neuse River Basin.
Let's take one step back and talk about the conditions. How was Kinston affected by Hurricane Matthew?
The way Murphy described it to me was, and I think this was true of a lot of places in eastern North Carolina, was zombie apocalypse. The image that he gave me was the first time it was safe for him to come out and take a look at his city was dawn, the next day after a lot of the flooding came through Kinston. And he said, in the early morning light, with cars abandoned throughout the main drag of Kinston and several feet of standing water still there, you have to realize that Kinston and a lot of these communities had standing water there for weeks after Hurricane Matthew. It was surreal. That's the best way he could describe it.
Well, how are things there now? How are the recovery efforts, and what does it look like?
Things are much better in the way of but flood mitigation. So I should take a step back and say that about $1.5 billion has been allocated, or rather promised, to the state of North Carolina for Hurricane Matthew recovery. Not all of that, a huge chunk of that, has not been allocated. It should also be said that the estimated damages for the entire state are $4.5 billion. So there's a huge gap there. There's a lot of it that hasn't been allocated. And I think, as Leonita said, that there are still a handful of families that are living in hotels today. That number has gone down a lot, but that's kind of where we are right now. And not a lot of flood mitigation has happened since then. You can put up, physical barriers like sandbags, but those really only go so far.
Well, and you can see how that would press against BJ's argument that, it's a good argument for mitigation, but with so much need just for recovery. And we're talking about last year's hurricane. We're not talking about this year's hurricanes yet. So that might be, sort of the pressure against it. There's, the amount of money it would take. Are there others who are with him on this? Other mayors and local officials in eastern North Carolina?
He told me he has tried to put together a coalition of leaders at the county and local level throughout the entire Neuse River Basin. The example that comes to mind for me is Windsor in Bertie County. It famously had an issue with FEMA funds being allocated after Hurricane Matthew. For months afterwards, they had an emergency management department that was totally destroyed, but they couldn't actually get the FEMA. And they found a site for a new emergency management department, but they couldn't get FEMA to release it because there was some conversation over whether this was a historic site and whether they could actually put a physical building on that site. So for a long time, they were still operating out of, I believe, an abandoned trailer at a high school or elementary school in Bertie County.
Professor Gavin Smith is actually working with Windsor as well.
Well, Leonita Inge is Lisa Phillip and Will Michaels, our reporters here at WUNC, giving us an update on the mitigation efforts and the recovery efforts after Hurricane Matthew. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks
for having us.
You can find links to their reporting at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, North Carolina writer Wiley Cash reimagines the historic 1929 Loray Mill strike in his new novel. Our conversation comes right after this.
And have a union here.